Welcome back to The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's a job that's more than a job. It's an adventure that also provides 100% universal health care, dental care, housing benefits, education opportunities, child care, subsidized groceries, and burial benefits. It's the job of being a warrior for America's military. But is it really just a job with great benefits, or is it a social program, a social welfare program in camouflage? Jennifer Mettelstadt is professor of history at Rutgers University, and she's the author of the book, The Rise of the Military Welfare State. And we invite you into our conversation as we talk about her book. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. You can email us your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. And Professor Mettelstadt, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me, David.
So the title of your book is provocative, The Rise of the Military Welfare State. Welfare, a lot of people think of, you know, you collecting welfare, you're not working, you're just getting money for nothing. So is that a provocative title or not?
Well, I think some people might hear it that way, but to be very clear, I think that scholars, myself included, in history and also in the social sciences, use the term welfare and social welfare in a really different way than most people do. Most people, as you suggested, think of welfare only as kind of means-tested public assistance for very low-income people. But when we talk about social welfare, what we mean is welfare in the broadest sense of the word. We mean welfare as those programs and policies that basically promote well-being for citizens. And so social welfare in a welfare state can allow us to see the wide varieties of different ways that various governments or private entities or charities all provide for the welfare of citizens and human beings that are sort of within their domain. And so that is what we're really talking about here when we talk about the rise of the military welfare state, is the way in which the United States, unbeknownst to many people, actually provides social welfare for many citizens through the all-volunteer force.
Well, some people did take, I guess it was a raw nerve maybe you hit for some folks. I saw some blogs that were thought that you were being antagonistic towards what the compensation that people in the military are getting. One blog said, if Mettelstadt is so envious of the benefits that the members of the military provides, why isn't she at the recruiter's office putting her signature on the dotted line for the job security and the medical benefits?
I think that some people have read it that way, and of course I too have seen some of those blogs, and actually over the course of doing the book, I was in conversation with lots of people who are in the military. In fact, I couldn't have done the book without talking to people within the military, and often their first question was, why would you be talking about the military as a welfare state unless you wanted to cut these benefits? And I always had to make clear that what I was doing as a historian was trying to point out this wide variety of ways that the United States provides social welfare and how the all-volunteer force has emerged as a really important component of social welfare for the military personnel and their families who've served in it, often when it's very difficult to find decent social welfare benefits outside of the military. And so as a historian of politics and the military, I'm really interested in this bigger question of how the U.S. government sort of provides benefits for its citizens overall. Why does it make certain decisions and not others? I will say that then once I talk more to military people, and especially those who've taken the time to read the book is actually very sympathetic to military personnel and is very supportive of those benefits. In fact, what the book does is chart the rise of these benefits and then their fall in recent years as they have declined, and they've declined for a number of reasons that maybe we can talk about later in the interview. But it ends with a real warning about what it means to take these away, to privatize, to roll them back, what that means both for military personnel and for civilians.
And what about national readiness?
Well, national readiness is a very important issue also. I mean, the whole growth of military social welfare benefits is largely a result of the switch from the draft to the volunteer force. Under a draft, really, the military didn't have to do much for the vast majority of people who were drawn in for short stints to serve as citizens as part of their obligation to the state for a certain period of time. The U.S. has had the draft since World War II with a short break in 1 year from 47 to 48. It had a draft all the way up through the end of the Vietnam War. And benefits that existed in the military were really for people who were officers, or they were a privilege of rank, people who had really decided to make the services a career. Well, once the decision was made to switch to the all-volunteer force, it was going to be very difficult, especially for the Army, which is the largest of the forces, and it's the subject of my book. It would be very difficult for them to recruit and especially to retain personnel if it wasn't going to provide them with the kind of supports that they needed to be able to live a basically middle-class lifestyle. And so the Army moved very quickly on studying its option to and studying its options to expand benefits and create new ones for all ranks and for family members in the volunteer era. And so it's really undergirded the readiness of the all-volunteer force. And it raises the question, of course, in my book does, if you roll these back, what will happen to the readiness of the volunteer force? What will happen, really, to the all-volunteer force, period? Will they be able to recruit and retain personnel in the future?
And the skill sets that we're asking our military warriors to have nowadays is a lot more intense than ever before. It used to be you just need to know which direction the Claymore mine had to be pointed at. But now we're asking cybersecurity. That's a high-level, intense job that there's a lot of demand for in the private sector, and we have our cybersecurity force that's trying to protect the nation's internet and things. They deserve to be compensated.
Absolutely, I agree. We're in total agreement on it. There's no disagreement about the compensation.
Yeah, and so, but there's competition to lure them away from these jobs after they've been trained by the military for these jobs, and so it kind of puts a different light on this package of benefits that you could look at it as.
I see what you're saying. Yes, in other words, this competition coming out of the military or trying to keep people in the military from the private sector, should benefits decline, could be stiffer. And, I mean, I think you do see that. You see it particularly at the level of personnel who have real particular expertise and officers who are lured into special military contracting jobs or into other positions with corporations. After maybe, say, 10 years or 15 years, some of them will do a whole career. But, yeah, it is alluring, the wages that some of the private sector firms who are looking for certain military specialties can pay, and whether or not the military is able to compete with them through the maintenance of these benefits is an open question.
All right, so we're speaking with Jennifer Mettelstadt. She's a professor of history at Rutgers University. She's the author of The Rise of the Military Welfare State. We invite you into the conversation. Got a question? Got a comment? We want to hear from you. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Source continues after 1 minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. When someone signs up for the military, they're also signing up for a social safety net that includes medical, dental care, education, child care, financial counseling, housing assistance, legal services, and other privileges that have long been reserved now for career soldiers. But now it's universal in the military. This is all documented in the book, The Rise of the Military Welfare State. We're speaking with the author, and that is Jennifer Mettelstadt, professor of history at Rutgers University. Our phone lines are open. If you want to join the conversation, talk about what your experiences are in the military with these benefits, 210-614-8980. And James is on the line. Hi, James. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Great. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think this is a great topic. I'm prior Army. I served for 6 years. And let me just say, I love the military. Our country wouldn't be what it is without the military. But at the same time, in my experience in the military, there are a lot of people who are working and getting paid, but not necessarily providing any benefit to the military or to the country. You know, there's so many positions within the military that are now contracted out to civilians, and we have civilians running the logistics. We have civilians running hospitals. We have civilians running all these other departments. But you have the soldiers or the airmen or the military members there who aren't necessarily doing anything. And every day they show up to do extra duties. They're there. They're on the books in case they deploy. But we haven't had a lot of overseas deployments in the last couple of years. And so they're on the books. They're getting paid. They're getting benefits, but not necessarily fulfilling any duties.
All right.
And then at the same time, you know, they can't leave the military because their income is so high that you can't find an equivalent job with some of the skills that you have. And so a lot of them are afraid to leave the military and leave the benefits and go out into the public sector.
All right, James, thanks for those two good points. We're going to explore both of those. Jennifer?
Yeah, well, I'll speak to the question of the privatization and the outsourcing. So what this book charts is the history of the growth of these programs with the switch to the volunteer force in the 70s and 1980s. And when they were created as programs that were run by the military and civilian government employees for military personnel and their families. And what James is referring to is a switch that, historically speaking, really, we can really trace to the 1990s, where we see a growth in the privatization and outsourcing of all kinds of military services, but also these social welfare services. So I think when most Americans think about the privatization of the military, they're thinking about private military contractors like the no longer existent Blackwater, for example. But what this book traces is that actually the bigger numbers in terms of profits and in contracts came from privatizing really kind of everyday things that we don't think about as so vital to the military, but which actually are, which are things like housing or healthcare or social work or accounting. They sort of seem on the boring side, but they're actually really vital and quite important. So this privatization and outsourcing is what the book tracks as well, trying to think about how and why this occurred. And it occurred for political reasons, a shift in national politics in the 1990s with Bill Clinton embracing a politics of outsourcing, and also the Republican Congress at that time embracing that same agenda as well. It occurred because of the agenda of military contractors who were worried because of the drawdown after the Cold War that there really wouldn't be enough contracting money in weapons and materiel. And so they pressed quite hard for outsourcing and contracts in social services and in housing and things of that nature. And it also occurred as the military itself tried to adapt to a scarce budget environment. What could they do to make their budget look lower each year? And it looked like contracting would be one of the things that, let's say, a post commander could do to make the budget, which was declining every year after the end of the Cold War, sort of make ends meet. So there were a wide variety of forces. But what has been the outcome in the end is that a large portion of military social welfare is not actually provided by the military or even by civilian government employees. It's provided by private contractors, by corporations, and for the civilians who work for corporations, people who really aren't directly involved in the military at all.
You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm speaking with the author of the book, The Rise of the Military State, Jennifer Millistat. And so what about James's other question? He says that there are people in the military, they're not private contractors, they are, you know, in the military, and they don't want to leave because the benefits are so sweet.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting perspective. As a historian, one of the things I've been interested in is when I talk about this to military audiences, people often want to talk about the question of whether or not there are people who are there who sort of are like welfare recipients. They're sort of getting something for not doing much at all. And as a historian and as a scholar, that's not really the question that my book addresses. I'm really working from the assumption, and that's what it looks like in the archive, you know, when I'm looking at the sources, because that's what historians do, you know, we look at the records on this. I'm looking more at the facts of which people are using which programs, why they're using them, how they're effective for them. And there, James is right. These programs have been very effective for military personnel whose standard of living rises considerably the longer they're in the military. So it has a really positive effect on your long-term economic outcome if you stay in the military for 10 years or more. And that's a combination both of the salary, but mostly it's the package of social welfare, which puts you in a much more solid economic and social status as a result. And I think it is hard to walk away from that. But I would say that that's true for most Americans. I mean, I work a job at a university, and I, too, have a social welfare package. And it would be very hard for me to walk away from my health care or other kinds of disability insurance that will come alongside my job. And I think that's true. I happen to work at a public university, but I think that's true for people who work in the private sector as well. It's true for many Americans. We work in large part in our political economy for benefits, since the government itself tends to provide relatively few compared to other industrialized nations.
Okay, another caller, Robert. Robert, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. Just quick comment about the last person that called. I don't know in which military he is, but in the United States Air Force, we are bare bones at the moment. They have cut thousands of people out of their jobs, and we are doing triple of what I was doing 13 years ago when I joined. And I have never seen anybody idle, not doing anything, waiting to be deployed. I can speak only for the Air Force. Now, being so sweet that we cannot find anything in the civilian world, that is not entirely true. I'm an aircraft mechanic, and American Airlines will definitely pay way better than the military pays me. The benefits are good and the stability are good. I agree with that. But with a social network like that, there's a lot of things that come up too. Like, for instance, our medical benefits are great, but there's no competition within. So if I get treatment and I get malpractice on me, I cannot sue back. The doctors that are hired, military doctors, are not top of their class when they graduate, because if not, there will be doctors in the civilian world. I will take comments offline.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. So Jennifer, Robert works is in the Air Force. He's an airman. If you, knowing what you know about the benefits and of the different branches of the military, and you were looking for the best package, which branch would you join?
Well, I have to confess, I only studied the Army. The Army is the largest of the services, and from a historian's perspective, it was the one for which the draft was most vital. I mean, the Army was relying on the draft for half of all of its personnel at the moment that it switched from the draft to the volunteer force. So it just made an absolute scramble into the volunteer era, looking for anything and everything that it could use in order to recruit and retain people. So I'm not an expert at all on the Air Force or the Marines or the Navy, and I would say that, you know, from the brief knowledge that I have, they evolved somewhat differently, though now they tend to have more or less the same compendium of benefits allotted to them.
I would say
also, just to echo the caller's point too, there's just another reduction in force that just took place. So it is true that the services are at the smallest amount that they have been in decades in terms of personnel.
Right, and that brings to the next question about how much of the military budget goes towards these benefits. And is that why we're seeing the reduction of force? Because as they reduce the force, they can save money.
Yes. So the proportion of the defense budget that is devoted to what we would call manpower, which is a combination of salaries and these various kinds of social welfare benefits, that amount has varied over the years, and it has varied based on not so much the spending on these programs, which has only increased in real terms since 1973 when it started. So it's only gone in an upward direction. However, the percentage has changed depending on how much spending there is on other things in the Defense Department.
So we're short on time, so what's the number?
The number today is somewhere around 25%.
But it's been as high as 50%.
It's been as high as 50%. That's what it was in the 70s and the beginning of the early 80s. Yes.
Jennifer Milestad is the author of The Rise of the Military Welfare State. Thank you so much for joining us. This is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.